There are new laws that you should know about. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. More than 100 new laws took effect this weekend. They cover issues from school security, the ability to purchase a gun, and attempts to curb the opioid crisis. We'll take a look at some of those new laws and how they impact you. Also, we'll hear from the director of the Fairchild Tropical Botanical Garden about their new program to grow food in outer space. And we talk with the two winners of the United Way's Inspire 305 grant competition. One of them focuses on getting females into computer science. The other brings music to people with Alzheimer's and dementia. Finally, have you seen the large mural of Neymar Jr. in downtown Miami? We'll introduce you to the muralist.
There was a music video shot in front of it with some dancers. That was amazing.
All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. This past weekend, dozens of new laws went into effect in Florida. These include laws geared at increasing safety and funding for education. There are laws that try and curb the opioid epidemic and, of course, controversial laws geared toward gun violence and school safety, as I mentioned. There are bigger issues, of course, and there are laws that deal with little things, underage marriage, drones, statues, etc. Well, joining us now is Elizabeth Coe, reporter with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times, joining us via Skype. Elizabeth, such a pleasure to have you.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
People may forget, we're entering the middle of the summer. This is when budgets start, new budgets start, and new laws go into effect. So things change. Let's talk about budget. Florida's budget starts. It is the largest budget in state history. What are a couple of unique things, though, we should know about this budget?
So, as it is every year, the two biggest parts of the budget are healthcare and education, and you see a lot of healthcare spending go up. There was about $900 million budgeted for additional Medicaid costs and another $130 million for Medicaid funding for nursing homes. Florida Forever, which is a land conservation program, got another $100 million, and there was also a really big tax package that provided for some Irma-related damage costs and some breaks for nursing homes that were purchasing generators relating to an emergency rule that requires emergency power to power air conditioning after the tragedy last year. But there is definitely a lot more spending in education in particular, and that's on significant increase because of the Parkland bill that was passed in the last half of the session.
Yeah, let's talk about some education-related stuff. As we talked about, education spending. Some educators are not happy that the per-pupil spending didn't go up that much, but that's also because of the fact that, again, schools now have to spend more on safety.
Yeah, so it's complicated. So technically, to hear legislators tell it, per-student spending went up by about $100 per student, a little bit more than that. And the concern that some districts have had is that most of that spending was earmarked for safety because of the Parkland legislation. It's been set aside for stuff like school resource officers and school hardening, making students safer. But the amount of that money that can be used for a school's general operations, we're talking like teacher raises or paying electric bills, that hasn't gone up very much. That's about 47 cents per student is what advocates say. And they're arguing that they don't have enough discretion to spend the money in the ways that they need because it's been earmarked for other stuff.
The other controversial education-related law, of course, dealing with the voucher program. This now allows kids who are bullied to possibly get a voucher to go to a private school. How's that set up exactly?
So that basically falls under the purview of Step Up for Students, which is a nonprofit in Florida established about 20 years ago that basically will take the money that is set aside for these scholarships and then give that to students who are technically bullied to be able to go to private schools or use that money to get transportation to another public school or a charter school. And that's something that is being rolled out and basically is drawing money from a sales tax when you buy a car, and you can basically voluntarily put additional money into this fund that will then pay for these scholarships that will then be distributed to students. That doesn't go into effect until later this year or next spring because it's now collecting money and the scholarships are basically being parceled out based on how much money comes into that fund.
So lots of education stuff. I'm going to just skip through a couple of these, but because we talked about safety on campus and what schools have to spend. There was also another really the hot one, and this is now an issue really across the country. We talk about teachers unions, education law that goes into effect impacting teachers unions. What's going on with that right now?
So there was a portion in the big omnibus education bill, 7055, that basically said teachers unions need at least half of their membership to pay dues. And the argument was essentially that if less than half of your membership is paying dues, you're not really representing all the people you say you're representing. And teachers unions were really, really strongly opposed to this, basically saying, you know, this is not necessarily something that is applicable to other unions in the state, like police and fire. Why are you singling us out? And the unions are actually just suing. They just filed a lawsuit challenging that portion of the bill. And part of this, too, is that Florida is a right-to-work state. And so within that territory is that you can't require people to pay dues. And teachers unions are saying in this lawsuit that that they have been singled out is particularly unfair and egregious.
And then the, of course, the controversial Guardian program. This is the superintendents have to designate a school safety specialist. What can you tell us about that?
So that is a portion of the big Parkland bill that was passed in the last days of the legislative session. And the bill that we're talking about technically went into effect upon Rick Scott's signature in March. But as part of the rollout of a number of these programs, the school has set certain deadlines as we go into the school year. And one of those is that superintendents need to designate a school safety specialist by July 1st. And also by that date, school boards are expected to know how many people they intend to train in this Guardian Marshall program that you mentioned. And that was pretty controversial during session because at first it was a program that would have allowed teachers to be armed, and that hit a lot of pushback from teachers, from gun control advocates. And so now what the Guardian program does is that it authorizes some trained personnel to carry guns if they voluntarily opt in, and it exempts personnel who exclusively teach in the classroom.
We're talking with Elizabeth Coe, reporter with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times. We're talking about the new laws that are now in effect in Florida. They went into effect on Sunday because, of course, that is when the new budget year starts as well. And we talked about the Florida budget. Want to shift over now from education issues to another big one here in Florida, of course, the opioid crisis, new law that tackles this. It limits the amount of opioids that a doctor can prescribe. What else does the law do?
So it does a couple of things. In addition to the limits, which have some exceptions, it updates the state's drug monitoring program so that it integrates with other systems that check patient records and things like that. And doctors or their staff are required to check that system before they prescribe or dispense drugs so that they can see what a patient's controlled history has been. It's also requiring doctors to take a two-hour class by the end of January of next year about prescribing opioids, and that is required every time they renew their licenses. There's also a issue where it's requiring Florida to share its state database with other states because the opioid crisis isn't something that necessarily pays attention to state borders. It's a nationwide issue. With regard to the opioid limits on doctors being able to prescribe drugs, there's a number of exceptions. So because doctors in the state were particularly opposed to setting limitations, they carved out some exceptions for people who have cancer or a terminal illness or severe traumatic injuries. If you're receiving palliative care, that's also accepted from the three-day limit that they've set.
And have we seen anything from doctors as a result of this law arguing about their effectiveness, basically their ability to help their patients?
They have. They've been resistant to the law. The limits on opioid prescribing, these kinds of caps, is something that other states do, but doctors in Florida have said, you know, this would interfere with our ability to care for our patients. And so some of the exceptions I was talking about, specifying cancer and the exceptions and things like that, those were added into the, or clarified, I should say, clarified in the law to kind of address some of those concerns.
So we move from some very serious laws and important laws to something, and I want to downgrade this. It is serious, but it's also strange. I mean, we had this very strange set of laws in the state when it came to minors getting married. And so now there's a law that protects minors from having to marry before the age of 18. But what was the law before?
So the law before basically said that if you were a minor who was 16 or 17, you could marry with your parents' consent. And there was also a provision in the law, which now is no longer in effect because we're talking about it, that said county judges could approve marriages with minors who were even younger than that if there was a pregnancy involved. And there was an activist up here in Tallahassee for about 6 years named Sherry Johnson who pushed for this loophole to be closed because she herself had been assaulted when she was very young, when she was 8, became pregnant at 10, was married by 11, and she was allowed to be married at the age of 11 because there had been a pregnancy involved.
And this goes to every state has them. Those laws that have just been on the books for decades, if not more than a century. Why did it take so long for this thing to change?
It's one of those issues that I have found when covering the legislature, that bills that don't pass one session just keep coming back. And I think one of the issues with this that Sherry Johnson has mentioned when she's talked about the law is that when she went to legislators at the start of her six-year campaign to get this loophole closed, a lot of legislators just told her it wasn't true. They just didn't believe that something like this could be on the books. But it is. And so the law now basically says if you are under 18, you cannot be married. The only exception is if you are 17. Basically, there are very, very narrow exceptions that say if you are 17 and you're in a relationship with someone who is within 2 years of age, then you can be married if your parents give permission. But Johnson had pushed for an exclusive ban on all marriages under the age of 18, and this was as close as she could get.
Seems strange to think that lawmakers wouldn't believe a law is on the books when you could just go to the books and find out. But, oh well. Elizabeth Coe, reporter with the Miami Herald, Tampa Bay Times. She joined us via Skype, again, talking about the new laws that went into effect this past Sunday throughout the state of Florida, and, of course, the new budget that kicked in as well. Elizabeth, thank you so much. Appreciate the time.
Of course.
All right, still to come, a South Florida program that aims to help astronauts grow their own food in outer space. How does that work? We'll find out. Coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, astronauts are constantly trying to push the amount of time they stay in outer space. This, of course, so that they eventually could return to the moon or go to Mars or beyond. Now, one of the things that will help in these extended space trips will be the ability to grow their own food. And that's where the Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden in Miami steps in. They've received a $750,000 grant from NASA for a Growing Beyond Earth Innovation Studio. Now, this studio will help NASA with its goal to provide astronauts with the ability to grow their own food with little or no intervention through a new makerspace. Now, this is the first public makerspace dedicated to NASA's food production challenges. The community workspace will provide a place for anyone to contribute to the creation of new food technologies. Joining me now in studio is the director of the Fairchild, Carl Lewis. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Such a pleasure. All right, so what sorts of foods is the Fairchild helping NASA figure out how to grow in space?
Well, NASA has particular challenges related to food production in space. Of course, on spacecraft, there isn't much room. And so to find things that can produce edible food in that small spacecraft, that's a huge challenge. And so Fairchild is helping with all of the edible plants that might fit the bill.
And I'm just curious, because you talk about space, but I mean, as in how much space you have to have a garden, I guess, but it's also the limitations and the challenges of weightlessness and being in outer space. And I mean, what can you grow in space?
Yeah, well, so there are tens of thousands of edible plants on Earth, and presumably many of them would be useful on spacecraft. But of course, having something that's small, having something that grows quickly, and having something that's palatable, those are the things that NASA is looking for. It doesn't do any good if it grows well if the astronauts don't like the way it tastes.
Well, I would think just if you could grow food in space, I think it would be kind of cool anyway. But a key part of the work that you're doing is hands-on with students, teaching them about the program and growing food in space. Talk about your partnership with schools and how this grant expands upon that.
Yeah, so this is a second grant from NASA. We received a previous grant in 2016, and that's a program that's going to be extending through the year 2020, and that's the Growing Beyond Earth Challenge. That's part of our Fairchild Challenge Outreach Program. We have 150 middle and high school classrooms that we have equipped with the growth chamber that's analogous to what they have on the International Space Station. So we can send seeds and soil and all the materials for growing plants out to those classrooms, and the kids get to try all the different varieties of plants and see what grows best.
This was, as you mentioned, this classroom project, and you had schools from Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach involved. And again, the students would test these different edible plants. What are the experiments, though, that the students are going to be conducting going forward?
Yeah, so in the classrooms, it's mostly just seeing which varieties grow best. And we've had some great discoveries from that. We found some varieties that perform even better than any of the things that NASA had been considering before. But we also ask the students, as part of their research in the classroom, to think of ways they could modify the experiment. And we've had a flood of ideas about how the growth chambers could be improved, how they could automate, how they could get robotics involved. And at this point, we've had to just say, great, we write those ideas down, we'll use them later. But with the makerspace, we'll actually be able to say, great, turn that idea into reality, build it, and we'll test it.
And one of the other things, too, is that the students get to interact with people from NASA. So this kind of expands on their knowledge, but also kind of opens doors for them, right?
It's very gratifying. We get great feedback from the students. Just last Friday, we had a couple of varieties launched into space for the first time from this project. These are varieties of plants that the students found in their research performed well, and now they're on their way. They just arrived at the space station, and they're going to be studied in space. That's really cool for students.
You know, we have some audio from one of the students who participated in the Fairchild Challenge Growing Beyond the Earth, Alejandro Perez, an 11th grader at the Magnet School Biotech at Richmond Heights. He said collaborating with NASA inspired his interest in botany.
Now that I have been working with them, it makes me want to consider majoring in botany in college so that I can maybe in the future work up in the ISS growing the plants for them, maybe planting plants in Mars.
So this grant, will you be able to advance this program and open it up now to the public?
Yes, anybody that comes into Fairchild that has an idea they want to turn into reality will make that possible.
And what kind of tools? I mean, if I come in just as a regular guy off the streets, what kind of things am I going to be able to work with?
It's going to be great. We'll have 3D printers, we'll have laser cutters, we'll have CNC milling machines, so we'll be able to fabricate things quickly. The idea is to take those ideas and make it into something that they can test.
And it's not just that. You want people to actually come in with ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
Share their ideas.
And we know they're out there. I mean, that's the great thing about crowdsourcing these things. The ideas come in abundance.
We're talking about growing food in outer space. NASA's trying to figure out how, and they gave the Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden in Miami a grant for a Growing Beyond Earth Innovation Studio. This is the first public makerspace dedicated to NASA's food production challenges. And we're talking with the director of the Fairchild, Carl Lewis. Describe a little bit about that relationship with NASA. You know, when did it start? How did it start?
It started in 2015, and it started at a time, a lot of great things came together at just the right time. We had already had some success with classroom botany experiments through our Million Orchid Project, where a lot of classrooms had been growing orchids, rare endangered orchids, to plant out in Miami. And just about that time, NASA was doing their first experiments with the veggie equipment on the International Space Station. And that's equipment that's just dedicated to producing food. And we realized that that's something we could replicate pretty easily for classrooms. And we reached out to NASA. They thought it was a great idea. I think we overwhelmed them with the number of participants and the amount of data that we provided that first year. But after the success of that first year, that's when they decided to fund the project through 2020.
And a lot of that data came through because of the fact that you were working with students. They helped collect the data.
Oh, yeah. They do everything. And it's hundreds of thousands of points of data. I mean, they are planting the seeds every day. They're taking observations. They're measuring. They're recording all the data in a giant online spreadsheet. And we have a statistician on staff at Fairchild that helps to analyze everything and provide the data to NASA.
I really want to dig in, and I pun intended, on what you can grow in outer space. What has NASA told you about what it's figured out, what it can and can't do?
Well, right, a lot of it has to do with the limitations of the spacecraft. On the International Space Station, there's no cooking facility, so everything has to be eaten fresh. That's a limitation. And there's a particular interest in leafy green vegetables because of the vitamins they provide. And those are vitamins that are not available in the freeze-dried preserved food on spacecraft. So we are having a lot of lettuce, a lot of Chinese cabbage, a lot of things like that, leafy greens. So if you like salad, you're going to enjoy these things.
I got to tell you, I'm a guy with, you know, no green thumbs at all. And I tried to do a garden on my own and I screwed that one up. But, you know, I'm just thinking in terms of like soil, water, sun. How are they growing it in space?
And that's a great thing about the International Space Station, because that allows us to rehearse all of these technologies for travel into deep space. And things do go wrong. We find that things don't get watered. Water delivery is the biggest challenge in microgravity. Right now, plants can figure out which direction to grow because of the lighting. But it's the watering that becomes challenging.
But what do you mean by microgravity?
The low gravity, zero gravity on the International Space Station, weightlessness.
You know, I keep thinking back to that movie, The Martian, with Matt Damon. And he's trapped on Mars, and he's got to figure out how to grow food or he's going to die. And, well, he creates a garden. I mean, is it as easy as that, or is that just a silly movie?
Well, he's a botanist,
okay,
right?
See, so there you go.
This is a movie where the hero is a botanist.
There
I
you
love
go.
That, okay? But there certainly is an element of truth to the more we know about growing plants in different environments, the more we'll be able to deal with disasters like that.
This past Friday, because you mentioned SpaceX, the past Friday there was the SpaceX launch.
Yes.
And that spacecraft was selected to carry some of these plants, right? By
yes.
the students up to the ISS. You were there for that, right?
Oh, yeah. I was there for the launch. It was spectacular.
What's it like for you? I mean, as you're watching this, you're thinking about it, and all of this work that you've been putting together over the last few years is now packed up, and it's now heading up into space. And it goes to another level. All this research, all this work goes to a whole nother level now.
Yes. Yeah, and what I'm thinking about is how can I share this with the 15,000 students that made it possible? I mean, of course, I'm snapping photos of the whole thing, so I can share that with everybody. Because really, truly, every one of those students has had a part in this success.
Now, how could people take part in this? Because again, this is a maker space. So this is an opportunity for any of us. If we want to participate and again share ideas or possibly help in the research, how could anybody do that?
So we're going to open to the public in the spring of 2019. So that's going to be exciting. But right now, you can come to Fairchild and see our Growing Beyond Earth equipment, the equipment like on the International Space Station. We have that on display. We have, especially this summer, we have interns, high school, college interns buzzing around doing research on the space plant issues. And then we also have a robotic gardening setup that we just installed at Fairchild. It's a demonstration. So at least you can come to Fairchild right now and get some good ideas.
And you talked about the robots. You talked about a 3D printer a little while ago. Is that
yeah.
already set up?
Yeah. No, the 3D printer's not set up. That's,
okay.
So that begins when the NASA program begins in October.
Something to look forward to. And again, they're looking for ideas. So this is a makerspace. This is an opportunity. It's not just for students. This is an opportunity for the public to get involved as well. This is fascinating research. Again, talking with Carl Lewis, director of the Fairchild. That is, of course, the Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden here in Miami. And, you know, talking about this $750,000 grant for a Growing Beyond Earth Innovation Studio from NASA, because, again, they want to look to find ways to grow food in outer space. Hey, if we're going to Mars. So we got to learn how to do it. Matt Damon kind of showed us the way. So, Carl, it's fantastic. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
All right. Still to come, we meet the artist behind the Neymar Jr. mural in Miami. He did two other similar ones in New York and New Orleans. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN.
Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control Nine. To Major Tom. Eight.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, Brazil knocked off Mexico in yesterday's World Cup match to advance to the quarterfinals. There are people who are still upset about that. That made plenty of fans, though, in South Florida happy, as a large number of Brazilians and their fans continue to follow the cup. Now, you may have seen in Brickell City Center a massive mural of the Brazilian star, Neymar da Silva Santos Jr. He goes by Neymar. The mural is part of the larger-than-life campaign launched last month by the sports website Bleacher Report. That's to get fans excited about the World Cup. Some of us don't need the extra excitement. We've got it. Miami is one of three cities across the United States with a mural that's similar. There's a mural of Egyptian star Mohamed Salah, or Mo Salah, in Times Square, and the French star Paul Pogba in New Orleans. The man behind the murals, Brandon Odoms, who joined us via Skype.
I think for me, it was just this idea of human potential, I think, that we're all attracted to. I think this is why we were excited to watch sports, why we're excited to watch, you know, people perform at the highest level when they do it well, is because there's this level of human potential that we're all attracted to. And seeing these guys perform on the level that they're performing in was an attraction for me, like being able to understand like what it took for them to get to that stage, what it took for them to get to that level in their career. I think, and also it was the idea of how much pressure is on each of them to perform. You know, when you think about the platform that the World Cup represents, their entire country is on their back. Their entire country is rooting on their success. And that has its own levels of story and emotion and just the idea of facing this huge task and being, you know, all that's necessary for you to succeed. I think I was able to tap into all that through the research that I looked at with all of these individuals, like their stories of how they got there and finding things to relate in all those different small moments of their story. I think that's what I pulled the most from that moment of trying to find the right image, trying to find the right look on their face. And, you know, so each of them, I saw that their hair had this such a unique characteristic about them. Like each of them, their hair told a story on its own. Like, so I wanted to use the hair in each of those portraits to kind of continue to tell the story. And so I used the hair as a way to talk about what they did on the field, or to also talk about what their country represents. So the hair was a unifying factor in all three of the paintings, as well as I wanted to focus on what each of their country represents, whether it was the country, the flag of the country. So I used the color palette of each of their flags in the portraits. So as you see from the Neymar one, the entire building is painted green, almost to look like the Brazilian flag. So these were the things I was thinking about as I was developing the thoughts and the ideas that created these pieces.
What's been the reaction especially on social media from fans in Miami to the Neymar painting?
It's been amazing. I can tell you that for that, just seeing the response. I think every day I get tagged on somebody's photo or a few photos, and it's always dope to see the types of, like there was a music video shot in front of it with some dancers. That was amazing. There was I think Neymar had, it was a competition or something he had in Miami, and everybody posed in front of it. They all had like cut out Neymar faces on their bodies. And it was just a shot of all these athletes in front of the wall. So it's been amazing to see that type of energy and that type of excitement around a static surface. Cause when you think about it, this wall is a wall. And I think as an artist, my job is to try to figure out how to make these static surfaces, these static images into stuff that has energy and life. And I think the people brought that out. I think the fanfare around the World Cup definitely adds to the excitement around these paintings. So it's exciting. I mean, I'm pretty sure if I go on my Instagram right now, I could find something in my DMs or something in my mentions that's a reflection of that painting or someone responding to that painting.
We're talking with Brandon Odoms. He is the artist who, if you've seen it, you probably passed by it here in Miami. There's this beautiful, large, beautiful mural of Neymar Jr., the Brazilian star, who's still in the World Cup, by the way, because Brazil knocked off Mexico this week. And he is the artist behind that work. Now, he painted three pieces in the U.S., one in Miami, one in New Orleans, one in New York. And this, of course, part of the Larger Than Life campaign launched last month to get fans excited for the World Cup. Do you feel any pressure, you know, when you're trying to properly encapsulate the image of a person, especially like Neymar, with Brazilian fans? Because, well, if you get it wrong, they might really get angry with you.
Yeah, I don't think the pressure hit me until I was actually painting in Miami. And I went through the whole process. It was a rainy weekend, so it was off and on the painting process. And I remember I was at the final stages of the painting, and I was writing his name on the wall. And there's a portion that says Neymar Jr. is larger than life. And I was tired. It was, you know, it's been 3 days straight of painting. So I'm writing it, and I wasn't paying attention that I had misspelled Neymar's name. And at this point in the process, you know, people would pass by. Some people would say something, you know. But for the most part, I think there was just process that people just felt like, you know, I was engaged, or they didn't want to engage with me because, you know, I was super focused. But when I misspelled his name, when I tell you there were screams from all directions at once, you misspelled, you forgot the Y. And it was such a moment that showed me, like, wow, not only are people paying attention, but people are watching to make sure I'm doing this right. And so from that point on, I think, because this was before I start getting feedback from not even people from that particular city, but people from those countries that I painted. After I painted the Mosala piece, there were so many people from Egypt that were contacting me saying, thank you so much. Thank you. So the pressure definitely began to develop throughout the course of the project. These paintings were done back to back. And I think the Neymar one was definitely the first one. And after that one, that's when I was like, okay, this is a big deal. But, you know, it was exciting. It definitely was, that type of pressure made it more exciting for me.
When did it all start for you, and how? I mean, was it a paintbrush? Was it a piece of chalk? Was it a spray can?
I mean, my story is pretty interesting, but to keep it short, I'm from New Orleans, and New Orleans is a very cultural-rich city full of art and soul. And I started off painting at a young age, doing art. I went to this high school that was super intentional about training artists. Once I graduated, I felt like I was done with it. I stopped painting, and I went into video and film production. I did that for 8 years, went to school for it. And it wasn't until after Hurricane Katrina, when there was a response to space in the city, 8 years after Katrina, that's when I started to look at it and pay attention to graffiti and street art in a way that I started to understand that this was a medium that was communicating in these spaces that were forgotten. And, you know, imitation is the highest form of flattery. So I started going into these spaces with spray cans and thinking, okay, I'm going to communicate as well. And I didn't know or expect that people would pay attention, but people did. The first space that I painted in, the whole city started to pay attention to, and people started to, you know, respond to the work. And like a conversation, the more people listen, the more you want to talk. And it just kept growing from there. So I've only been doing spray paint art for the past 5 years. And it's been a crazy wild ride, to starting off doing it illegally in the streets, to being at a position to do it in Times Square, you know, for the whole world as an audience. So it's been a crazy, super exciting, and I'm blessed to be able to be in this position, even have conversations to talk about it. So thank you for inviting me to talk about it on here.
Oh, no, it's absolute pleasure for us. You know, I think about, too, is the fact that, I mean, I go back and I look at a lot of your work from the past, and, you know, I think, for example, like your Project B, and... Mm-hmm. You know, all of these powerful social, historical images. And I wondered, what was it like for you then to step over and then start working on athletes? Now, it's not to say you've also done Muhammad Ali, I believe, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I don't, you know, you go from some of the work of your past. I don't know if there was a big shift to now doing something where you're, you know, you're painting athletes. And, you know, you want to bring attention to a, you know, an event, the World Cup.
Right. Not so much so, because I think what I am attracted to in terms of the images that I started off painting and still paint, as far as historic moments and individuals in history, I'm attracted to, once again, the idea of human potential, the idea of there's an attraction level of what they accomplish. You know, we all have our heroes. And for me growing up, my heroes were ones from the history books. It was less athletes and entertainers. It was more historic figures, people who had made great sacrifices to make the world a space that they felt was better for all of us. And so from the same idea, though, I think the same formula exists in the way that these athletes are also this heroes, and they also represent a type of human potential that we all can hope to become or hope to be like. You know, to think about the level or the sacrifice, the performance, the type of energy and intention that it requires to be at the top of your game, there's a lot that one can pull from and say, okay, I can also do this, or I can hope to be like this. And so it's the same type of idea when I'm painting Neymar and when I'm painting Dr. King. You know, it's the same type of human potential, the same type of me hoping that someone can see themselves reflected, or the best of themselves reflected in this portrait. And so with that in mind, you know, that's the way I treat the types of subjects that I paint, the types of projects that I work on. How can we have a young kid in Miami identify with Neymar from that perspective, to say, okay, he made it out of a condition that many people might not want to be in, and he made something larger than life out of himself. You know, so I think those are the aspects that I find to be mirrored, I guess, in a way, in some of the paintings that I had painted in the past.
Brandon Odoms, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You can see the pictures of these three murals on our social media. Just look us up, WLRN Sundial, on Facebook or Twitter. They are really, really cool. Well, still to come, we're going to meet the two winners, the two winning groups, I should say, of the Inspire 305 grant. One project tries to get more females into computer coding, and the other brings music to Alzheimer's patients. That's coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN.
This July 4th, Miami Music Festival Symphony Orchestra presents Patriotic Pops, featuring Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, Copland's Appalachian Spring, and other all-American favorites. Info at miamimusicfestival.com.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Wygreen. For hurricane season, Wygreen is dedicated to providing fast and affordable financing for storm protection home improvements such as impact windows, roofing, and generators. Learn more at 1-866-IMAGINE or wygreen.com.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, last March, United Way of Miami-Dade launched a $35,000 grant competition called Inspire 305 for budding nonprofits. After hearing about the prize money, 50 applications were narrowed down to 7 finalists. Miami-Dade residents picked the winners. The $25,000 grand prize went to the nonprofit Coat Art, a local organization using workshops and after-school programs to increase gender and racial diversity in computer sciences. The Trailblazer prize of $10,000 went to the nonprofit Mind and Melody. That's a network that brings interactive music classes to nursing homes and other healthcare centers to transform the lives of people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And we're joined now in studio with Mind and Melody co-founder and president, Christina Rodriguez. Christina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here. I'm so excited.
Also, Code Art co-founder and executive director, Amy Renshaw. Amy, such a pleasure.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. So, you know what? I mean, first of all, congratulations to both of you. These are fascinating projects. Let's talk about what they do, what you want to do with these. Amy, let me start with you. Help us understand, by the way, the gender disparity in computer sciences. How serious a problem is this?
It's a pretty serious problem. So today, only about 18% of computer science graduates are female. But that wasn't always the case. Back in the early 80s, nearly 40% of graduates were female. But that's declined, and Code Art looks at the reasons why, and we try to compensate for those and reverse the trend.
How much of it is the way that we promote computer sciences to the genders? I mean, do we just make it really cool for guys women don't want to do it? I mean, what are we missing?
Well, that's kind of the root cause, because up until, like I was saying, the early 80s, 40% of graduates were women. And then with the introduction of the personal computer, the computers were marketed almost exclusively to men and boys, and the video games that followed thereafter to the boys. And so all of a sudden, the boys were getting this introduction to coding much earlier than the girls. Then when they met up in high school, their first computer class for the girls, the boys always already knew a lot, and the girls started to drop out in higher percentage. So we're trying to get the girls started earlier and also tailor it, our curriculum, in a fun, friendly, maybe more girl-friendly way.
Why did you want to get into this? What was the spark for you?
For me, it was pretty personal. I studied engineering and worked as an engineer back in the late 80s, early 90s in Silicon Valley. And back then, I was the only woman on my team and often the only woman in the room when we met. But I never imagined that that would still be the case for my daughter 25 years later. But she was studying computer science, and her very first internship, it was the exact same thing. She was the only female on the team. She loved the work.
A generation later. Nothing's changed.
And that's when I started looking at the numbers and realized that even though overall in the other STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, all other STEM fields, the percentage of women had been increasing over that time, except for computer science. And it's because of that focus back in the 80s that the boys were getting in earlier. And like you alluded to, the gender stereotypes in the movies and TV, where the coder is typically this antisocial kind of loner coding late at night in the basement. And so girls get the message that, I'm social and creative. Maybe this isn't the thing for me to do.
I think back to, you probably remember that really cheesy 90s movie Hackers, right? Remember that one? And it was just all guys except one woman, you know. Angelina Jolie, what is your program going to do? Is it about getting young women involved earlier, or are you trying to open it up and show them that there's a lot more than just this boring sit down? And
it's both of those. We're trying to be the on-ramp to coding for girls so that they're getting it in elementary and middle school. So when they meet up with the boys at first CS class in high school, they don't feel like they're behind. And we do that through creativity. All of our curriculum is designed with an art basis where they're learning loops in order to create like a Jackson Pollock-like image and things like that. So,
All right, Christina, let's talk about your program. Tell us about Mind and Melody and how that got started, because there's a personal connection for you.
Yes. So I've always been fascinated by the intersection between music and art, music, art, and medicine. And I started playing the cello when I was 10 years old. And I would go home and I would start recording myself and just play for hours and hours, and I wouldn't realize that hours had passed by. And I started volunteering at Nicholas Hospital when I was 14 years old. And I saw that a lot of the kids there would stay for extended periods of time. So I wanted to bring an environment and create a room filled with instruments where the community could come in and create music without having years of training. So this idea stuck with me for about several years, and I started learning more about the impact that music has on the brain, especially on people with neurological impairments like dementia, Parkinson's, traumatic brain injury. And it was so magical, all of these stories that I kept reading. So when I came to my junior year of college, I met the co-founder, and we decided to create a thesis that would create a program for older adults with dementia and Alzheimer's that would go beyond just listening to music, but creating music.
And all that research that you were reading, what does the research tell us about that link, you know, with music and helping people who have these different brain traumas or, you know, things like dementia or Alzheimer's? What does music do? How does it help?
Absolutely. So it helps the person's behavior, and it helps them connect with the world in many different ways. For example, with somebody that has Parkinson's and they may have problems with their gait and motor skills, when you start playing certain types of music, you may not even realize that person has Parkinson's anymore because their gait now is normal. But once you turn that music off, they go back to shuffling their feet. So it's kind of like this on and off switch in the brain that accesses all these different parts that are spared by these diseases.
And so when did you start actually just bringing in music to some of these centers? And I mean, when was that moment when it's like, wait a minute, there's something here that might actually be good?
So that was in 2014. My co-founder and I partnered with the FAU Memory and Wellness Center in Boca Raton, and we started the program there for people with memory loss. And I remember we had one volunteer there the first day, and she had her cello, and we just started, you know, playing music and talking about the particular, you know, composers and having them name different tunes. And from there on, we started seeing the impact that the program was having on the individuals and on the musicians. And 8 months later, we realized this is what we want to spend the rest of our lives doing.
And it's not just playing music for them, but also letting them play music too.
Absolutely. So we incorporate, we bring a team of young people and of musicians into our sessions, and they create a music experience for them. We bring a variety of instruments like a saxophone or keyboards or guitar, and we create music activities for the residents to engage in. So they're cognitively stimulating, physically, and creatively stimulating.
And I mean, give me just one quick example, a story maybe of someone, whether it's a dementia or Alzheimer's patient, how music had a profoundly positive effect on them.
Yeah, it's a little hard to choose just one because there are so many of them. But one of the most recent ones is there is a lady that we started visiting in December. She is in the very late stages of Alzheimer's. She's in a wheelchair. She can't move on her own. She can't feed herself. She can't communicate. We thought and the family thought, you know, what can we do for her? So we started out with one session per week. We started playing music and she completely lit up. Her facial expression, she was able, you know, she was smiling, she was following people around the room.
Was it a certain type of music?
It was music from, you know, from when she was younger. Okay. So from the 30s to the 70s, she loves Italian music. So we started doing that. Then the family said, wow, this is an amazing response. Let's do it 2 times per week. So we started doing that. And then it came to 3 times per week. 6 months later, she was able to say her name. And this was someone that, you know, wasn't able to produce any kind of speech whatsoever. Even her caregivers outside of the session say, we do this name game that goes, my name is
Yeah,
And
well, I got to tell you, I mean, I completely understand this because I can relate in the sense that I had a family member who passed away from Alzheimer's. So listening to you, that's an amazing thing that you can get somebody who hasn't spoken to start even just saying their name. That is incredible. Again, I'm talking with the founders and directors of two amazing organizations, nonprofits, that recently won the Inspire 305 United Way grant competition. Talking with Code Art and Mind and Melody, excuse me. They both, again, won the prize money for Inspire 305. And talking about what these programs do and what they mean for their different communities, Code Art's director, executive director and co-founder Amy Renshaw, and also Mind and Melody co-founder and president Christina Rodriguez. Amy, let me come back to you. Schools can request a code workshop from you, and you have a few regular workshops that are going on in libraries. Is it about expanding now with this grant into more schools, more libraries, or where are you going to go?
Yeah, so we have a lot of different programs, but we're going to use the grant to expand our after-school coding programs. Right now we have 3 weekly coding clubs. One's at a library and 2 are school-based. And so we're going to start at least 3 more of those, either in libraries or schools.
Is there any consideration of partnering with private tech companies to expand as well?
We've done that, yeah, and we want to do more of that. Actually, this past school year, we did our first corporate-based workshop series with Sapient Razorfish, and that was really successful. So in addition to the girls getting the coding skills and seeing the creative side, they were actually learning those skills in a tech environment and getting inspirations each month from workers at Sapient Razorfish about how they use coding and creativity in their everyday job.
I wondered what schools are not doing right and how you can help them, because I go back to what you said, you know, it's just getting the girls involved, getting different groups involved early. Mm-hmm. Is it about making it more fun and interesting for them? Or, I mean, what do you have to do?
Yeah, making it more fun and interest. We want to create a mood of delight and inspiration around coding. And so we reach out. Computer Science Education Week takes place every December. And so a couple of months before that, we reach out to all the schools in the area or clubs and say, we'll come in and we'll do an hour of code with your students.
And I think about the fact that, as you said, you know, your background, you know, in your career, what's the responsibility from big tech companies to do more to get more women and minorities involved?
Well, it's actually in their self-interest. So it's proven that products are better when the teams are more diverse, and they can't fill all the positions right now with the number of graduates they're getting. So it's win-win. So definitely hope to have more of those partnerships.
All right. Christina, real quickly, how are you going to expand now with this grant? How are you going to expand Mind and Melody? What do you envision in the coming months?
Yeah, so we're looking to provide our program to facilities that haven't experienced our program before, and also to individuals that are living at home. You know, so if there's anybody that is interested in bringing our program into their home or into their facility, you can contact us. Our website is www.mindandmelody.org.
Are you collecting any research right now on, you know, you're spending time with a lot of these patients, a lot of these folks, to see what works, what doesn't work, how? Because I think about the story you just told. I mean, that's mind-blowing.
Absolutely. So I'm glad you bring that up, because it's something that we want to formalize. We want to formalize a partnership with the university to study our program. In the meantime, we are collecting our own data, and what we measure is engagement in our sessions. And we do that through socialization, creativity, and physical engagement. And we have various indicators that we use to measure those outcomes. So what we look for is, did that person actively sing during the session? Did they play their instrument? Did they show awareness of themselves or of other people? So we score these different behaviors throughout the sessions, and then that's how we collect our data.
I want to hear from both of you on this one as we wrap up. Is I wanted to get the sense of what you think about the fact that Miamians voted for you, and what does that mean? I mean, that says a lot. But I mean, Christina, how does that feel?
It's so exciting. You know, your vote definitely counts. That's that's what I really want to, you know, to say. So vote. Sometimes it may feel like, oh, okay, I was voting every day and it may not make a difference, but it really did. And thank you to everyone who voted.
And Amy, what kind of feedback were you getting?
I mean, I was so surprised and overwhelmed by it. We weren't getting a lot of feedback. It was a 30-day voting process. And, you know, I know that our programs have touched people and they're grateful, but honestly, I didn't expect people to log in and vote every day for 30 days. So it really warmed my heart that they did.
Well, again, congratulations to both of you and continued success as you push these programs forward in everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
And again, talking with Amy Renshaw, the co-founder and executive director for Code Art, and also hearing from the co-founder and president of Mind and Melody, Christina Rodriguez. Again, both of them winners of the Inspire 305 program, the competition set up by the United Way of Miami-Dade. You can find out more about them on our social media. Look us up, WLRN Sundial. Look us up on Facebook and or Twitter. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great holiday, guys. I'll talk to you again on Thursday.